Warning: the following account contains graphic descriptions of medical interventions and death that may trigger some listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to the Queen's Memory Podcast, brought to you by the Queen's Memory Project. The stories you're about to hear were collected for our archives to document the experiences of Queens residents during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm the Queen's Memory Community Coordinator, Meryl Agish.
Breaking news, Governor Cuomo has just extended the stay-at-home order for New York State.
There's too many people still in hospitals, and there are not enough beds to meet the reopening requirements.
Of getting extremely pressed and perhaps being overwhelmed.
The Department of Defense is deploying some 1,000 military medical personnel.
We desperately need a relief valve for the system.
As healthcare professionals battled the pandemic in hospitals, and citizens of New York stayed home to slow the spread, there was another unsung group of heroes acting as an intermediary between the two. First responders.
871 and Medic 6, you're seeing a 74-year-old male, shortness of breath, down a two-word sentence.
Stand clear.
Rushing into people's homes to save lives is difficult under any circumstances. But in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, first responders faced even greater challenges in the line of duty.
Everything we studied for and everything that we trained for is no longer happening.
It becomes mentally exhausting because you're looking at a dead person.
We're finding people dead in their cars. We were finding people dead in their houses.
Under such enormous strain, these heroes often lean on their professional communities for support to get through each day. But for first responders of color, those professional communities can sometimes feel fraught, as they often lie at the intersection of COVID-19 and the second pandemic we discussed in the last episode, systemic racism.
The thing about 9/11 is that so many firefighters died that the FDNY became so unified. But that same unification didn't really happen during this pandemic.
They've never been exposed to our culture and our lifestyle. It's weird to them, almost.
These personal stories are not well documented by the news media. Without real-time documentation, memories can fade and facts can be misremembered, making it difficult to reconstruct lived experience and create change. In this second season of the Queen's Memory Podcast, we will feature these first-person accounts from our community as we get through this historic pandemic together. Today's episode takes an in-depth look at the unique challenges of being a Black first responder in this historic moment, as reported by our producer, Sam Riddell. Let's listen.
We were just finding out that people were getting sick.
In early March 2020, New York City streets went from bustling to silent in a matter of days.
It was almost like an eerie feeling, and all you heard was lights and sirens going back and forth, up and down the streets.
The city was the latest spot to be rocked by the coronavirus pandemic. The borough of Queens in particular became the epicenter.
When we saw the freezer trucks, like, this stuff is really real. And we can't believe that it's happening in our own community.
I can watch three people die within an hour. It's definitely looked a lot worse than what is portrayed on the media.
It was just like a war zone.
Those are the voices of two native Queensites and first responders who have worked on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic in the world's borough. They are
Diana, last name Wilson.
Diana's pronouns are she and her. She's a 41-year-old EMT for the Fire Department of New York, also known as the FDNY.
I grew up in Rosedale, Queens. I work in Springfield Garden, Queens.
And there's 28-year-old Rob Semple, a firefighter working for the FDNY whose pronouns are they and them.
I live in Queens my whole life. I live in Kew Gardens, and I work in Corona.
At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic in New York City, these Black, Queens-based first responders responded to their community in a time of critical need, all while dealing with grief, isolation, fear, and a countrywide racial uprising. Rob's career as a firefighter coincided with the start of the pandemic.
It's almost like a bird being pushed out of a tree, and either you fly or you fail. And we got kicked out that tree. We found out Friday that Monday was our last day.
On March 18th, 2020, a class of 309 probationary firefighters faced a rude awakening when their 20-week class was cut short by 14 days in order to get them out on the front lines tending to coronavirus patients. Diana, on the other hand, is a seasoned veteran.
I've been working in EMS for the past 17 years.
Yet, neither someone on their first day on the job nor their 17th year on the job could quite prepare for what was ahead.
We train for everything. We train for active shooting. We train for terrorist attacks. We train for Ebola. And here we are faced with a pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic caused a notable shift in how first responders did their jobs in New York City. In the thick of the pandemic, the FDNY's medical 911 call volume rose from a typical 4,000 calls per day to over 6,500 calls per day. Perhaps one of the most heartbreaking changes was a spike in
cardiac arrest.
Cardiac arrest is the sudden loss of heart function in someone who may not have been previously diagnosed with heart disease. In early April 2020, New York City saw a 400% increase in cardiac arrest home deaths, believed to be driven by surges in COVID-19 cases.
Back to back to back cardiac arrest.
Maybe in an 8-hour tour, you'll get like 1 to 2 cardiac arrests. Since this pandemic has started, like 10 cardiac arrest in an 8-hour tour.
People are finding people and knowing like, hey, I'm calling 911 because I can't get into this apartment.
We're finding people dead in their cars. We were finding people dead in their houses.
CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, is an emergency life-saving procedure performed when the heart stops beating. It involves chest compressions and ventilation. According to EMS protocol in New York City, CPR should be initiated on all patients in a state of cardiac arrest, unless signs of obvious death are present or the patient has a do not resuscitate order.
CPR is not easy because you got to go real deep because you're massaging the heart. But then it becomes mentally exhausting because you're looking at a dead person.
Traditionally in New York City, EMS will perform CPR on cardiac arrest patients en route to hospitals. But in an effort to stave off new admittances in the city's overwhelmed medical system, a new rule was implemented.
The protocol was for the pandemic that after 20 minutes, if you have no electrical rhythm, you pronounce them dead.
And that's not like us, because if we get your pulse back and we're really fighting for you, sometimes we're on scene for 45 minutes. It's frustrating because everything we studied for and everything that we trained for is no longer happening. And also, when you go to the hospitals and they keep asking us, why you keep bringing the patient here? We're looking at them like they're crazy. And we're like, what? Do you understand what? Like, are you kidding me right now? But when we saw the freezer trucks, I think that put everything into perspective for us.
There were two of them. They were in the middle of the street, so the traffic could no longer go by. And we were there for, I'll never forget this, we were there for a total of 10 minutes. We saw three bodies being wheeled out. And as we drove off, we drove behind a hearse. At first, I was fine. And then one day I came home and I just laid in bed for about 2 days.
I would leave the station, change my clothes, put my clothes in a bag, come home, wash my uniform, go straight and take a shower. And I barely ate any dinner because I was so exhausted. I had to lay down and mentally and physically prepare myself for that next day. And not seeing my children, not having my husband, it just pretty much took a big toll on me.
In April 2019, Diana's husband passed away at the young age of 42. Just about a year later, in order to protect her children from potential coronavirus exposure, she sent her kids temporarily to live elsewhere.
Coming home to a quiet house was very, very strange. Because my husband will be here, my stepchildren will be here, my children will be here.
According to Rob, many firefighters seek solace in their partners.
A lot of them have spouses or wives or girlfriends or whatever, so they do have somebody to go home to. I am one of the only single people in the house, and I live alone.
Isolation, along with grueling work schedules and witnessing a high volume of death, can all lead to stress, anxiety, and other detrimental mental health outcomes. And community, or lack thereof, can play a huge role in one's ability to cope. The FDNY offers both its firefighters and EMS personnel services for mental health support. However, neither Rob nor Diana utilized those. Instead, they sought out a more personal approach. Diana began after hearing that two of her colleagues died by suicide during the pandemic.
I just put out on Facebook, hey guys, you know, reach out if you feel like you gotta talk to one another. And just doing that simple thing using social media, I received 5 phone calls from my own coworkers that I would have never thought they felt they needed to talk to somebody, like crying and sobbing on the phone.
I finally spoke to my best friend, who's a rescue paramedic, And I told him everything that happened. And I was like, what do you do? Like, how are you so brave when you see things even worse than me? And he explained, like, you know, don't think that I don't feel it too. I just found ways to cope with it, and you will too. So that's been my thing now, is just finding ways to cope.
It was difficult. It was difficult, and I felt like I had to turn to prayer, and I had to turn to my own faith to ask for strength, and I felt like I used that to get me to listen, because sometimes it just takes a matter of listening to a person and telling them, I hear you, and we're here for each other, and we're going to get through this together.
But a sense of togetherness isn't always present for first responder colleagues.
I found out my grandmother died on shift. I was at work. My grandmother passed away from the same thing that I'm battling. So you can imagine how that felt. And the response was, I mean, do you want to go home? If there's 25 people in my firehouse, I heard sorry for your loss once. They didn't tell me that bereavement started the day after. So I never took bereavement. I missed my chance to grieve. The thing about 9/11 is that so many firefighters died that the FDNY became so unified. But that same unification didn't really happen during this pandemic.
On the EMS side, the pandemic hitting close to home played out a bit differently. In late March, FDNY EMS Station 54 paramedic Crystal Cadet became ill with COVID-19.
Cadet is one of our paramedics at our station, and she was on a light duty at another station. She was told to still report to work, and she has an underlying ailment.
That ailment is self-described by Cadet as normally well-controlled asthma, an ailment that Cadet is 20% more likely to have as a Black American woman than a non-Hispanic white American woman.
But they kept telling her, nope, she gotta come to work. So here you have us coming in and out of houses with people with COVID-19, and now we're bringing it back to the stations. Whether we are symptomatic or not asymptomatic, you don't know because we weren't being tested at that point. We find out she's sick and she's in the hospital. And in this group chat, we are talking to her, literally sending text messages. Hey, Cadet, how you feeling? She's like, hey. She's like, I'm a little upset. And we're like, why? What's going on? She's like, because, you know, I'm Haitian and I like my Haitian rice and they're trying to give me brown rice. Like, we're cracking jokes. Like, just eat the food. You got to eat. You got to get better. And it went from joking to the next day not hearing from her at all.
On March 21st, Crystal Cadet's condition significantly worsened. She was put into a medically induced coma and placed on a ventilator.
And we're like mortified because we're like, we just spoke to her the day before. The statements that we're being told, you'll ask someone of a higher authority. That's how I'm going to put it. Hey, how's Cadet? Did anybody check on her? Because I know you guys are supposed to check on her. Oh, yeah, no. She got sick because of her sickness. She didn't get sick because of COVID-19. To even put that in the atmosphere, to even say it to us as a group that we're supposed to be here together, that pissed me off more than anything in my life.
The response to Crystal Cadet's health could be viewed as particularly frustrating given the nature of hazard pay and EMS in New York City.
First responders were supposed to receive hazard pay. So we heard that the nurses got it. We heard that the doctors got it. But who are the ones that bring those people to the hospitals and go into unknown situations? And then the governor said, yeah, EMTs and paramedics, they should get it. We have not received anything.
It's also worth noting that even in non-pandemic times, the first responder pay gap is a major point of contention between EMS personnel and the city. Starting pay for an FDNY EMT is about $35,000 and rises to $50,000 over 5 years' time. For an FDNY paramedic like Crystal Cadet, pay begins at $48,000 and in 5 years rises to $65,000. Conversely, starting pay for a firefighter like Rob begins at $45,000 and rises to $110,000. While NYPD personnel, on the other hand, begin at $42,000 and grow to $85,000, and an estimated upwards of $100,000 with overtime, shift differentials, and other benefits. After a month in a coma, Crystal Cadet woke up.
Amen. She's alive. We prayed for her every day as a group. And I just really, really hope and pray that she has everything that comes to her, because she's a warrior.
In the same month that Crystal woke up from her coma, the streets of Louisville, Kentucky, and cities across America began chanting the name of another Black woman who had been in EMS.
Say her name!
Breonna Taylor!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
Breonna Taylor was a 26-year-old Black EMT who was killed by the Louisville Metro Police Department during a no-knock warrant search on March 13, 2020. Her death and the deaths of countless other Black folks at the hands of police in this country have ignited a series of uprisings in support of the movement for Black lives. For Rob and Diana, stories like Breonna Taylor's are painful.
To hear Breonna Taylor and to know that that could be me, I'm worried. To know that I have to have that conversation with my boys every day of how they have to conduct themselves, and I teach them to be law-abiding citizens, but just because of the way they look, they're gonna be judged. I'm worried. It's scary.
An added layer of Black trans people being over-policed, underprotected, and killed at disproportionate rates causes additional stress for Rob, who is a Black transgender person themselves.
It's also interesting how it doesn't stop. A pandemic and a quarantine doesn't stop the murder of Black and brown and trans people. It may slow it, but it doesn't stop. There is no safe time. If this isn't a safe time, there would never be one. So I have to skip over the articles.
Even at work in their own departments, a lack of cultural and racial awareness are present for both Rob and Diana.
So we largely serve Corona, Elmhurst, and Flushing. The firefighters in my group, most of them being white and not understanding Latinx communities and people of color communities. Like, we get into these apartments and they're super duper small, but there's a lot of people in them, and they're always like, how do people live like this? And I don't want to say anything because I'm like the rookie, I'm the probie, but how do people live like this is poverty.
Diana serves Southeast Queens. The neighborhoods in this part of Queens are predominantly Black.
St. Albans, Laurelton, Springfield Gardens, Cambria Heights. So now what we're seeing is a lot of young white males coming onto the job because now they want to be firefighters. They're not firefighters. You're on EMS side. When you walk into someone's house, you treat that family member as if they're your family members, and you treat them with respect. But I think they don't understand the culture. They don't understand what it means to live in the inner city because they're so used to living in the suburbs, and they've never been exposed to our culture and our lifestyle, that it's weird to them almost.
Diana, unlike rookie Rob, has a little bit more room to speak up. It also helps that New York City's EMS force is made up of 54% racial minorities, while the fire department is made up of only 22% racial minorities.
And now with all this Black Lives Matters and people protesting, we're starting to hear conversations. And I let people talk. But when you start walking left and saying crazy things, that's when all buck stops and you're going to hear my mouth. And you're going to hear everyone else's mouth.
In mid-April 2020, troubling preliminary data on COVID-19 showed that the disease was disproportionately hospitalizing and killing Black and Latinx New Yorkers. The data reflected racial disparities in coronavirus fatalities from all over the United States, showing us all that systemic racism and the health disparities that come with it will rear its ugly head even during a pandemic. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic and racial uprisings causing additional stress on Black and brown lives, it's important to have culturally sensitive first responders who care about the communities that they serve.
My favorite thing about living in Queens is I'm never too far from any diaspora. So even though I live amongst Caucasian and Jewish folk, I can go a couple blocks away and be around Guyanese and Latinx people, or I can go a couple blocks the other way and be around Black people. I had one Black woman. She had Guyanese trinkets in her house. Her nephew was there. He was from Barbados. He wasn't crying or wailing or anything. He was just talking to her. Just talking. Maybe a couple tears would come out, but he was just talking. Like, remember that time when this happened and that happened? And it's like, you're so strong. Like, whatever happens, happens, but I feel like you got this. Like, it was just so loving. You could feel actual love in that room. I felt personal. I prayed. I never prayed. I prayed. I didn't switch out for about 3 rounds of CPR. That means I did CPR for 6 minutes. I was praying to God, praying like, just please, just please, just one time. Just one time. Just give me a heartbeat. Like, please, please. And I got a heartbeat, but it left. Then it came back, and then it left. So the conclusion was, even if she did make it to the hospital, she didn't make it very long, or she was brain dead. I realized that, okay, if I'm treating somebody who looks more like me, not that I try harder, but it just becomes more emotional.
My favorite part about Queens is actually the culture, different nationalities, and just people in general that, you know, work as essential workers in the community. Just knowing that I work in an area that I can possibly walk into their house one day and I'm actually taking care of them. It's a gratifying job as far as when you know you're helping someone, especially when you grew up in that community. And just a simple thank you to Queens for allowing us to come into their house and allowing us to become their advocate for their loved ones and leaving them in our care and entrusting them with us to take them to the hospitals. Believe it or not, we would sit in our trucks crying. At one point, I thought I was going to quit my job. But I knew I couldn't give up. We were out there emotionally and physically drained, protecting every single patient that came our way. We did everything we could. And I want you guys to know that if we had to do it all over again, we're going to do it again. Queens for life. Love you guys.
Join us next time as we continue to reflect on stories brought to us from you, our Queens neighbors. If you're listening with others and want to reflect together, here are some guiding questions. Who are your unsung heroes? What changes do you hope to see locally and nationally? What will you no longer take for granted? The Queens Memory Podcast is a production of the Queens Memory Project. This series features a selection of personal stories from the borough of Queens in New York City. For full transcripts, translations, content notes, and resources from this episode, see our show notes at queensmemory.org. This episode of Queens Memory was produced by Jordan Gospure in conjunction with Sam Riddell, Anna Williams, Joanne Wong, and Natalie Milbrot. Editing by Anna Williams with mixing by Brianna Stodden and music from Elias Raven and the Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks for funding support from the New York Community Trust. Queens Memory is an ongoing community archiving program by the Queens Public Library and Queens College CUNY. I'm Mara Lagiche. Listen with us next time on Queens Memory.